This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Teresa Henderson and Terry Lawrence. How are you guys?
Good, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Welcome to Cotignac.
Cotignac, yes, we are in Cotignac, which is in...
And southern France, Provence.
Provence, you've got to say it with Provence. Provence, yes. And we're going to be talking about Mirabeau, which is a rosé producer here in France. It's strangely enough, it's owned by some English people, the Cronks, from what I understand.
Absolutely.
And we're going to be talking about how they started out. Because they've gone from almost nothing 15 years ago to being one of the major Provence rosé suppliers, particularly to the UK, and number one in Australia, I understand, as well. So international market in 15 years is really good. So what I want to do is explore the history and maybe some insights into the issues that came up during that. And I imagine we're with Tessa, you're the finance director, because when you're growing hard like that, that must put a lot of strain on a business. And then, Terry, what's your role here?
I'm the managing director for France.
Which means?
I spend all my time on the French paper administration and all this thing, because the French are known for all these regulations.
Yeah, red tape. You're the red tape man, yeah, and you're the finance lady. Okay, lovely. Mirabeau has grown quite hard for 15 years. When it started, in what year?
2010 was, well, Stephen and Jeannie arrived in 2009, a passion for wine and a dream to create a rosé that was accessible to everyone. And I think they'd always seen that rosé was the, represented sort of good times around a table, laughing with friends. So that was kind of their mission, to create that wine. And they started that in 2010, was the first millésime, or first bottle of wine. And Stephen managed in that first year to sell 10,000 bottles to Waitrose. He had a meeting with the buyer and he got his foot in the door and said that if he managed to get them on the shelf, he would make sure they came off the shelves.
Yeah.
And so Waitrose gave him that chance.
That's very good from zero. Did Stephen have any previous relationships with Waitrose, or what were they doing beforehand?
Stephen worked in telecoms before he came here. So he'd worked in wine in his youth, in his 20s, and always had a dream to go back to it. And I think there was suddenly a moment that his wife realised this dream was needed to be realised. So they agreed it was time to leave his job in the UK. They sold their house and they came here with this dream to create a rosé.
And a lot of people have had that dream, not everybody's executed as well.
Yeah.
2010 was probably a good time, because that was just at the start of the rosé revolution, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Particularly in the UK, because before around 2010, rosé was often considered a little bit naff. It was like you had white wine, red wine, and you had this other thing that some people drank. But about 2010, I remember it was like you were just starting to see rosé grow and grow and grow. So they got in at the right time.
Absolutely. They also quickly realised that they didn't have enough money to buy a vineyard, and that nor did they have the experience to make the quality of rosé that would need to be at a level to be sold in the UK. And they quickly realised there are a lot of farmers in the region that have this experience and have wine that they sell. So that's how they started the business. They started working very closely with some of the key farmers in the region, in the Cave cooperatives, which have big farms, farming huge hectares of vineyard. And that's where they first started and created Classic.
Yeah.
That slowly grew, started with Classic, and I think Pure followed about 2 years later, again in Waitrose. By then, I think they'd started working a little bit on the on-trade as well and going into other markets. But it was probably in 2014 that it started getting a bit bigger. And it was, I think they've always really grown in double digits until through COVID.
Yeah, and I would say the big boom for Mirabeau, it was in 2016 when Stephen did the video on YouTube. It was the most popular wine video, I think, in the world even. Yeah. It was 11 million watching. So I think the starting of the brand Mirabeau started in 2016, I would say, in my view.
Okay, what was the video about?
So Stephen, in one of his sort of ways of trying to get the wine moving off the shelves was, and they've always been quite modernized, I think, Stephen and Jeannie, in that, you know, working with social media. Obviously, this was pre-social media, so they worked with YouTube. He was doing YouTube videos all the time in Provence, trying to teach people about the region, about wines, all of that stuff. And he did a YouTube video on opening a bottle of wine with a shoe. Banging it against the wall and the cork pops out.
Do you know what? I don't know if I've seen that one, but I've seen a YouTube video about that.
11 million.
It went completely viral. You know, I think that was the start of... They followed that with now the arrival of social media. They're quite active on that, and one of the leading rosés in the region in terms of sort of followers on Instagram. But it was really kind of started out with YouTube and progressed from that.
And also they're making a good team with Jeannie because she's amazing on marketing, on social media also. So that's very good team,
And her creativity on the look and feel of the brand and the bottles, etc.
Yeah, it does have quite a modern yet classic feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite nice. Okay, cool. So, started out early, and how many bottles the first year? You said
10,000.
10,000, so small but growing. And can you give us the numbers? Just the first, because you said it was like the first 6 years, and then 2016 it just sort of went poof.
So, yeah, it really grew then, and it was probably around 200,000 bottles at that stage.
Okay, so decent.
Yeah. Exactly, and that was probably the point where they realised they wanted to start looking for an estate to have their own domain wine. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of, 2016, 2017, they really started thinking about that, and clearly they'd been funding the business and they needed to have external investment at that stage. So it's still majority owned by the two of them, still remains a family-owned business, but... buy a domain, but would need investment to help with that. So in 2019, having looked at a lot of different places, they found Domaine Mirabeau, which is over near Le Garde-Freinet, near Saint-Tropez. Mm-hmm. And there they've started farming their estate wine.
And where did they get the investment from?
Friends, really. I mean, Mirabeau, they're now friends. It's all private investment, not friends necessarily. It's people they met while they were sort of.
But some people have some passion on the wine. It's not just investment and want back a lot of money. It's more than, you know, we love wine and that's the thing.
Okay, lovely. And I suppose that was a good time, because 2010 was the start of the rosé, but by 2016 it was growing. It was double-digit growth rosé as a market sector, and it started moving from being a little bit naff to being quite almost mainstream again.
Yeah, because if we're talking about number, for example, in 2015, the turnover of the company was around 1 million, and now in 2025, it would be 15 million.
Yeah, oh gosh.
So the growth, it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that's... not doubling, but it's pretty close to it every year, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's really good going. Okay. And they bought their own domain, but you don't make a domain wine, do you?
Yes, we do.
Oh, you do? Sorry. Yeah. Which one's that?
La Réserve. It's a very small production.
Yeah.
It's around 3,000 bottles, I would say.
And we didn't taste the wines.
We are selling it on the on-trade in the UK, and we actually just shipped all the last bottles over there. To cover that market.
Okay, so let's talk about anything big happened between 2016 and 2025? Because we talked about the growth.
COVID.
Oh my God, yes, COVID. What was that like for you guys?
As for every business, it was scary because we didn't know what was going to happen, because we are fully outsourced as a business. Until that stage, we obviously didn't have a domain, but we also don't have any bottling facilities and the storage facilities. That is all outsourced. So as soon as lockdown happened, we weren't sure whether our production facilities were going to carry on running, whether the transport to our customers would carry on. So we did sort of shut down and go to minimum employees for about 3 days.
Yeah, it was super stressful. Also,
it was very stressful.
All the supply chain, it was super difficult to organize. So it was, kind of a nightmare, to be honest.
Everyone had to be at home. So we went to minimum employees in the office to sort of manage operations. But in fact, as we all know, that everyone stayed at home in the UK and they all wanted, it was a beautiful summer, and everyone wanted to drink rosé.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I think, like most people, we did actually quite well during COVID.
Especially because your wine market, I think we were talking earlier before we recorded, you said you were like 60% UK retail versus on-trade. So you might have lost a lot of the on-trade, but you were there.
At that stage, we were even more in retail.
Yeah.
We've grown our on-trade a lot in the last 2-3 years.
Okay.
But at that stage, we were mostly retail. So it was, in fact, a scary time because we never knew when transport was going to stop, when operations were going to stop. You know, one case of COVID in the production facility might have meant the whole place shut down. So we were all nervous. But by the time it got to sort of July, we realised, and actually things started opening up again, it was, you know, ended up not being such a bad year for us.
Yeah, yeah. When COVID hit, you probably had expectations of a certain volume, and you would have probably sold through that volume pretty quickly if you weren't careful.
Yeah, so actually what happened was that we had just taken on a new importer in the US, and we were planning to grow there. And in fact, we had a supply of wine that one of the reasons we were so nervous was because we weren't sure where it was going to be, if it was going to get to the US. And in fact, we were able to sell it all in the UK.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it? Yeah. So you had a lot of production ready for the US market and you just channeled it into your old market.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Oh, you lucked in, didn't you?
So, well, we didn't feel lucky at the time. Well, I guess by the end we sort of did. But it was, it was, as for most people, very stressful. Because also, we were, as you say, at a growing time and thinking about increasing staff levels. But because of COVID, we didn't. So actually, people were working in the operation side very hard.
Yeah.
The sales team were mostly on furlough because they couldn't see anyone or do anything. But operationally, it was sort of 50-50.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things that I like about Amaribo is that you're regenerative. To be honest, I'm not a huge organic fan. I find organics a little bit bad news because of the high carbon footprint associated with organics. But regenerative tends to clean up the carbon footprint, or at least hopefully it does. Yeah. You're also B Corp as well, so you're spending a bit of time trying to get good environmental credentials. Is that just with your domain or is it with your growers? How does it all work?
I would say both, because even for B Corp or regenerative, we're working for Mirabeau, but also for all the contractor and supplier, because we do a lot of survey about them, because we want to source. For now, for example, we source 80% all the dry goods in France.
Dry goods as in bottles?
Like bottles, cartons, all these things. So the strategy, it's like to reduce the carbon footprint, that's the main things. And concerning the regenerative, it's I agree with you about the view you have on organic, because in organic you can put a lot of copper on a salt.
Mm-hmm.
In,
well,
in the region, yeah, exactly. You have to, if you want to, about all the disease like mildew or all this thing. In regenerative, it's something totally different. So that's why sometimes we do some kind of macerations product to spray on the vine, like willow. So we spray willow on the vine.
Willow, like in willow tree.
Yeah,
tree.
Yes, exactly. Instead to put, we can reduce the copper volume inside. So it's all the philosophy, and because the thing it's to put some life in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So the strategy, it's okay to grow all the grape without any tailing on the soil, all these things. And now, like we saw before on one day, We're working with seven
suppliers. Oh, seven suppliers, yeah.
And we ask them to do exactly the same thing. So, but,
I mean, the domain only supplies about 5% of our wine. So clearly, if we want, and we are the first regenerative organic certified vineyard in France.
Yeah.
But that is a high standard to set, and it's not something we can ask of growers. And clearly 95% of our wine comes from other growers in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So Stephen's done a lot of research through the RVF to work out how best to work with growers, because, you know, ideally we would like all our wines to be regenerative.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to work with growers in a way that is the easiest for them to understand the philosophy of it and also to back it. So that's what Thierry and Guillaume have worked with growers last year. And as he said, they found seven, and that's how we've made one day.
Okay, so one day is your regenerative organic wine.
But our aim is not necessarily that we will have all of them organic, but it is to have all of them regenerative.
Okay, and the Marabou domain will be regenerative organic?
It is already. It is already. ROC certified.
Yeah. Okay. ROC.
Yeah.
ROC.
Which is, I think, the highest level of... It's regenerative organic certified.
Yeah, okay. Is that an American certification?
Yeah. We were the first in France.
Yeah, okay. And tell me about B Corp, because in the UK there's a couple of producers now who are B Corp. What is B Corp and what does it mean for you guys?
So just before COVID started, we started looking at B Corp, because the philosophy of it was something that Stephen and Jeannie believed in, which is when you're building a company, it's not just about company, it's about the profit, it's about the purpose, the people, the environment, everything, which is probably where the regenerative stuff all comes from too. We looked at a few things which were quite easy to attain, but we kept coming back to the fact that B Corp looked like the one that ticked the boxes for us, even though it looked like the hardest one to get.
Mm.
So we added that to our list of things to do during COVID.
Yeah. It took 3 years of working.
3 years of working. And
is that you, Thierry? Because I imagine B Corp has a lot of administration.
Yeah, but we have someone in the company who follow all this process, because it's a lot of paper.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the way that it covers all those things of, you know, looking at your people, looking at what you're doing for your community. The problem with wine is you do have heavy bottles that it's shipped in, which is always something that drags us down. But points we received was really across the board, not specifically in one area, it's across all of them.
And that's why now we have an action plan on a bottle to source a lighter bottle.
Yeah, you haven't looked at, because in Bordeaux, and I think there's a glass manufacturer in northern France who's moving to electricity for their furnace, so they can use 100% carbon-free energy to create their bottles. You haven't looked at that or anything?
Not yet.
The test plant, I think, in Bordeaux, and a test plant, a different type of a hybrid test plant in northern France as well. So there are technologies out there that I personally think lightweight glass, great idea.
Yeah.
I think it's a dead end, because I think just produce glass without a carbon footprint is better rather than lightweighting your bottle. So, and then you can have your big heavy bottles that everybody thinks is really important.
Yeah.
But you haven't looked at that type of thing yet.
Not yet.
Oh. Yeah,
I mean, we've got recycled glass, so the one day is in a recycled glass.
Mm-hmm.
But
you've got is it a custom bottle?
Pure is in a custom
bottle. Yeah.
It's a nice bottle, but
it's beautiful. It's a little bit heavier, but we only brought it out 4 years ago.
Yes.
And it's obviously quite expensive creating the mold, but it's certainly something already we know we need to look into.
We need to think about it, maybe. Yeah.
Because, of course, there is the side of producing it with better carbon footprint of production.
Mm.
But regardless, the weight of it, when you ship it, is also something that produces
packaging.
True.
Okay. So here we are in 2025. What's your position in the UK market?
We are up there in the top five, I think.
I saw top four. In global.
So what are they? You've got Whispering Angel.
Minuti.
Mini, I don't know that one. Okay.
I think that's quite big in France, Mini.
Yeah, yeah. It's 60 million turnover.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. And Miravel, and then...
Mirabeau. But I think in UK, I'm pretty sure we are one of the most famous brands because we are a lot on the social media.
Yeah.
And we are super close to the customer. And so I think we are different for sure. And also it's a family business.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. That's why it's a Stephen and Ginny. It's a family business. It's we are small, but we are close to the customer.
Okay. And where do you see the future? Because you're talking about before COVID, during COVID, you were very much focused on the off-trade, like supermarkets. But you're saying that now off-trade's growing. Is that a focus or...?
Yeah, we recruited a new sales director about 3 years ago, and that's been a big growth area for us in the UK, in the on-trade, to raise awareness for the brand. So that's a focus there. Germany is a focus market for us. Australia continues to be a focus market for us.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the US, although, of course, with Trump and his tariffs, it's not something we really want to focus on right now.
Yeah,
We're growing there, and whilst there are only 10% tariffs, we'll see. But like everyone, it's very unknown, so we just have to
See
what happens.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's fair. What about the Scandis, the Scandinavian markets? Because you're B Corp, and I would have thought that would play quite nicely with them.
They are quite hard markets to crack because of the monopolies.
Yeah.
And actually, Minuti, I think, is very big in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's just a very hard market to crack. And we've got a bit of a market in Finland.
Yeah. Do you do anything in bag and box? That's right up the Scandi market, isn't it?
We did for
once.
We did it.
It's not working for Mirabeau, I would say.
No. Put a premium wine in a bag and box, and people don't want to pay the premium price for it. So that's quite tricky. But
it's not so bad in Scandinavian markets. They have very good quality wines in bag and box.
Worked more on cans recently.
Oh, okay.
Couple of years.
Yeah. Jane's become a huge fan of canned wine because it's just like a single serve.
Yeah.
You know, I can drink a bottle of wine. Jane can drink a can of wine.
it is more eco-friendly. And so we have a really lovely IGP organic rosé in a can.
Yeah. Do you find the rules allow that for your Côte de Provence, or are you allowed to put Côte de Provence in a can?
No, this is an IGP med that we put in the can.
Okay. All right then. I think we'll wrap it up there, Tessa and Terry. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.